Right, everybody, winter is coming. It's time to batten down the hatches and invest in warm clothing. Fear not, though, for to keep you company in a long, dark winter night. We have the Linux Boys Podcast.
Woo! Yay, woohoo!
Woohoo!
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And together we bring you podcast Linux Voice Podcast, episode 13, season 4. We've got news to come. Quite a lot of news. I think lightning news might be thunder news this time, moving at the speed of sound rather than the speed of electricity. We've got some finds. We've got a barking dog in the background. There may or may not be some neurons to vocalise. And we have the voice of the masses. If you like the sound of that, but in paper format, you can subscribe to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com. That's all the weather. We should big ourselves up, really, shouldn't we? Yeah, you get 12 issues a year, and you can subscribe in electronic format, EPUBs, PDFs. Oh, my dog.
It's just excited by all these great offers that Linux Voice has.
He's the first to the post, so he always chews the magazine up before I can chew it up. so do that and spend your money, and you'll know it's money well spent because it's DRM free. Basically, yeah, someone else take over at this point. News,
right. I've pruned the news back, so we might still hit lightning news if we're fortunate. So first up in the slightly pruned news this fortnight is that only 7.7 of kernel I've lost the ability to speak. Only 7.7% of kernel developers are hobbyists or not paid for their development. Or another way of looking at it is over 92% of all kernel developers are professional, and they get paid specifically for kernel development. So obviously Linux is an open source project, anyone can contribute code. And in the past, it's been a lot of hobbyists, and it's gradually become more and more professional over the years have gone by. We've just hit 25 years. And on that milestone, 92.3% of kernel developers are paid to do it.
It's a really interesting statistic because it... It shows I remember all the years ago in the late 90s when Linux was sort of taking off and people were saying, oh, well, you'll never be able to make money from this communist free software open source thing. Nobody in their right mind would work on stuff that anybody else can steal and share. And here we are now. I mean, that's an enormous number. Okay, the Linux kernel is a very technical piece of software. It's not the sort of thing that a lot of newbies can dive into. But yeah, here we are, 25 years on. Lots of people are making money writing free and open source code. So you can make your money, you can put food on the table, but still help other people in a sharing community way. It's great.
Yeah, so a lot of these people will be paid by hardware manufacturers, people who work for sort of the various ARM companies, for Google doing Android stuff and all this sort of stuff. Also some people working for Red Hat, some even for Microsoft. Yeah, it's all sorts of companies really that come together to pay people to work on the kernel.
Yeah, how's this trending over time? Is it
it's from steadily
last,
decreasing.
Last year and 5 years.
Okay. So yeah, in 2002 it was 14.6%. So it's halved in 4 years. More or less.
2012?
Yes. So yeah, it's sort of gradually coming down at a steady-ish rate.
And I don't know. Does that mean that? I know that I'm going to ask a question that might be impossible for you to answer on the spur of the moment. But does that mean are the contributions from amateurs the same in terms of number of lines and patches, and there's just a lot more code coming from big corporations, or is it actually just reducing?
Certainly in the long term, it's been reducing. In the short term, I don't know is a simple answer. It obviously does get bigger every release.
One of the other things that strikes me with this 25 years of the Linux kernel, of course, is that Linus Torvalds is still the maintainer. 25 years. I mean, how many other free software projects or any software project can you think of where the maintainer's been there that long? Maybe there are some Netcraft guys who have been there since the start, or, you know, Bram Moulinar. I'm sure he's been involved in Vim since the 1990s. But yeah, 25 years, you know, and it's such an enormous job now maintaining all those code submissions. I know he has a team of people that, that patches filter through.
I'm pretty sure he's just the PR man at the moment, just writing friendly emails to sort of help encourage the team.
But he does issue final releases, doesn't he? He still sort of signs off on, I think he still does the final upload to the FTP mirrors. Yeah, he may do very little coding, but he still seems to be the technical guy in charge.
Yeah, he still seems to know what's going on at all the levels.
I suppose he's the editorial director in journalism terms.
Yeah, and shall we stick on Linus for our next item of news this fortnight? And this is, he's got himself into a little bit of a spat with Bradley Kuhn of the software, I always get this one confused, I should have written it down.
Freedom Conservancy.
The Conservancy.
Isn't there an L in there as well? Or is that what it used to be?
Software Freedom Conservancy?
Yeah, I think it's Software Freedom Conservancy.
I knew I should have made more detailed notes. Software Freedom Conservancy, about whether or not they should talk about the GPL at an upcoming conference. Bradley Kuhn said, well, yeah, this is a great topic, but it's important to everyone. Linus is more of the point that it's important to developers and lawyers should, frankly, stay away from it. And they tend to make things worse with lawsuits and whatnot.
There was also a really good post. I think it was Linus was responding to Greg Crowe-Hartman, another general, if that's the right term for Linux kernel development, who I think responded initially to Bradley by actually saying that I think Greg implied that he'd done more for protecting the rights of the GPL than the FSF and the Software Freedom Conservancy, because he's been working on writing code and helping developers write code and making the Linux kernel a viable alternative, which I think Linus, I think, responded to that in agreement. I understand the issues on both sides, but it's a really contentious subject, and you know, I've got a lot of respect for Bradley Kuhn as well.
Yeah, I read Linus's email before we came on air, and like you say, he does basically just forward on a mail from Greg Crowe-Hartman saying this is it. And I don't know, admittedly, that much about the topic, but one of the arguments they're saying is BusyBox, you know, the small set of basic command line utilities used in embedded space, that's had all sorts of GPL violation issues. Companies have put BusyBox in every toaster and you can name. But apparently all these lawsuits haven't helped development, have hindered it, developers have left. We can't let companies go around willy-nilly violating the GPL, but on the other hand, writing code at the end of the day is the best way to get free software out there.
And I think Ben, go ahead.
So obviously writing code gets software out there, but if that code is just locked down into a proprietary product, then is that... Because almost all of these sort of... Well, certainly the most of the big infringements of the GPL happen in the embedded space. People modify free software, put it in a toast or whatever, don't release their changes and push the product out. You know, it happens with phones, it happens with pretty much every IoT device out there that you can't get the code for. It has some free software in it, and a lot of it is infringing. Writing more code isn't going to change that. A manufacturer of whatever is just going to keep on doing it. And if you give them more code, that's great. That's just more code they're going to violate with. It's only if someone actually goes out there and stops them and says, hang on, you can't do that, you have to release your changes, that the free software actually moves forward, that the changes are released.
But I think there's more, there's also, especially from Bradley, a huge implication that the Linux Foundation knows that some of its main sponsors, perhaps VMware, are flagrantly disregarding the GPL. This is Bradley's thing, you know, and everybody's kind of carrying on as if this isn't happening. The people who are carrying on are the school of Linus, which is the pragmatists who want to see features and things progressing, whereas there's a more kind of idealist side from the SFC.
Well, it certainly seems acceptable to the Linux Foundation that if you pay enough money, you're allowed to violate the GPL. I mean, that's just the way it seems to work there. And that's that's not a good situation, really.
But that doesn't seem to have done Linux any harm.
Well, it's hard to say because you don't know what it would have been like in a... Maybe that's what's holding back Linux on the desktop.
Well, there's the other argument, isn't there, that the BSD license folks always use, which is to say it's rather fruitless for a company to take code, put their own modifications in secret, because if they don't get put back into the main source code tree, that they don't get worked on by other developers, you know, it ultimately it's better. It just makes more sense to contribute your changes back to the tree.
That's right, because what was that company that took the BSD and then they just withered and died because, Apple.
Hey, that's all, you know, that's almost a prompt for the next story, isn't it?
Well, we can mix the stories around. Should we move on then to look at how Apple have got on with taking free code, closing it down?
Taking free money and taking it to the United States.
No, not to the United States, to various tax havens. Hardly any of it goes to the United States.
Oh, that's right, because, I remember, was it Tim Cook who said, we're not going to bring it to the United States until corporation tax is 5%.
Yeah, Apple literally borrow money in the United States against their offshore assets to avoid paying income tax or whatever the particular tax is, to bring the money back into the UK, corporation tax. But this is the news that Apple owe €13 billion worth of tax to Ireland.
Which their government doesn't want.
Yeah, this is a really weird situation.
Say no, we've got enough nurses.
Yeah, apparently Ireland's doing fine and has no economic issues whatsoever.
So we should have our money back then, really, that we lent them.
That €7 billion we lent them, yeah. We personally, obviously.
us four.
Yeah. So the EU Commission has looked at Apple's tax relationship with Ireland and said, actually, this is the rule in the EU is that you cannot offer companies particularly favourable tax situations for moving to your country. You have to have a tax rule and apply evenly to everyone. And according to the EU Commission, Ireland haven't done that. They've sort of fiddled the rules to allow Apple to get away with paying sort of a fiver in tax just to stay there and employ Irish people rather than moving to another country. And they said, well, that's completely unfair. If you look at what's gone back over history, it comes up to around $13 billion that you owe Ireland. The Irish tax officer said, well, actually, we made an agreement. We shook hands in it in a Dublin gentleman's club over a pint of Bushmills and we consider the matter closed.
It comes in pints?
Litres.
Sorry, Ben. Go on.
Yeah. Well, that was more or less the end of it, really. Apple, the EU says Apple owes Ireland money. Ireland says we don't want the money. And Apple's basically not paying any tax as they haven't been before. And as you say, this is a company that takes massive, massive lengths to avoid paying tax. You know, so all their money's offshored with just pennies drifting back into other countries. You know, meanwhile, the manufacturers of their phones have to install netting around their factories to stop people jumping out the windows because they're such depressing places to work. Yet Apple keep telling us that they're such a socially conscious company that only have the best interests of the Irish people at heart.
Well, it sounds to me like the European Union is trying to infringe the sovereignty of the Irish government.
That's and what Apple said.
Ignore the will of the Irish people who don't want that money.
I don't.
Oh, it's a strange one, isn't it? It's a really strange one. You can see.
I'm not saying anything.
I would be slightly. Not that I think England should have money, but if this case was with the UK, it would be wonderful to see how Nigel Farage try to spin this.
Yeah.
As somehow still anti-EU. But,
I think it's disgraceful that companies that make so much money as Apple have to. I know that there are big differences of political opinion, especially in the United States, but I don't see what the problem is in paying their share of corporation tax and, you know, generating money for stuff.
Yeah, I mean, American law particularly is a little bit weird on this because they're basically required to do everything they can to maximize the value for the shareholders. That's their legal responsibility as a board, which includes not paying tax if they can get away with it. So they're almost legally obliged to not pay tax and legally obliged to pay it. But yeah, corporate world is all fairly messed up.
It's pretty low anyway in Ireland, isn't it? Even without any sweetheart deals. It's
that low six... really depends on your point of view.
Well, it's obviously it's not low enough. And or taxes, theft, etc. 12.5%.
Yeah, so Apple pays, if you sort of take a global average, it's less than 1%. So that's, you know, several thousand percent of what they usually pay.
Let's have some good news or bad news.
Let's move on to open source news at least. PowerShell. That famous Microsoft Bash wannabe is now open source and it runs on Linux like real Bash.
That's great news. It's almost as good as Bash.
Yeah. If you're using Bash and you think this is a bit too powerful for me, I don't quite know what I'm doing. Maybe if there was a simplified version. One thing actually is quite interesting about this news is now with Bash running on Windows, PowerShell running on and Linux, everything's sort of becoming mixed around a lot more. Obviously, this seems to be a trend that's going to continue where almost the root OS, the kernel basically, is starting to become more and more interchangeable.
Mm.
Even between, it's always been a little bit the case with sort of the Unix-derived OSs, the BSDs, the Mac OSs, the Linuxes, etc. But now Windows is starting to get involved in this as well. And we could start to see a world where there's less and less difference at a sort of what software you can use, and you can sort of almost create the right stack right from the operating system up that suits your particular task, whether that's Windows, whether that's Linux, and not have that that root OS affect the software that you can build on top of it.
I guess that answers the question I was going to pose and say, well, what is the strategy here? What sort of use case scenario is there where you want to be running a Unix-like operating system, but you want to run PowerShell? I mean, Cygwin has been around on Windows for ages because the Windows command prompt was abysmal and people wanted a real command line. But I'm just trying to think of what position would you be where you have the whole wonderful Unix user land and then you're like, yeah, but I still need this Windows shell.
I mean, the Unix sort of user land is fantastically powerful, but it's an absolute pig to learn. And if you've been working with PowerShell for the past 20 years or however long PowerShell's been around, and you just want to keep maintaining your server, you don't want to have to learn how to use Bash. Just put PowerShell on it, and.
But you think so many things. I know PowerShell is apparently quite powerful in doing things with poking around in the registry and Windows services and stuff. And if it's very heavily tied to them, if you put it on Linux and you can, run LS in a slightly different shell.
But if you don't need to do much more than run LS, you just need to copy some files around, keep services running, keep a basic server ticking over. Why not stick it on if that's all you've ever used? Why bother learning a different shell?
Yeah, but it's an interesting point. It's like you say, with this sort of more mixed combination of kernel and user land and apps, the sort of experience some people will have over the next 5 years. So, I'm used to using PowerShell, but on Linux and running X, Y, and Z, all the mixture of stuff. It's fascinating.
Yeah. And yeah, it's more, it's another move from Microsoft to integrate Linux a bit more or work with Linux a little bit better.
I think there should have been a PowerShell in Mario Kart.
Just not the blue shell, damn it.
What did the blue shell do? I've only ever heard people rant about it.
Right,
and so that's all we have time for now. See you in another fortnight. Bye.
It punished success.
It was communist.
It's how I will summarize it. Yeah.
It's the tax of Mario Kart, is it?
Right, let's move on to our final news item of the fortnight, and that is that the UK Labour Party has launched a digital democracy manifesto at a launch that completely failed to live stream and a website that doesn't seem to exist and appeared to break. But if you ignore the launch itself and sort of focus on the manifesto, which I could only find on the
on a carved on a giant piece of stone by Ed Miliband.
Yeah, well, the manifesto itself appears to be a PDF that is linked to some CloudFront CDN that doesn't actually have a sort of website pointing to it. But anyway. What I think is particularly interesting about this is that they've actually got one. It's one of the only political parties, at least in the UK, that has actually said, this is what we think, this is what we would do with the digital world, digital rights, etc., if we got into power. And, this is something we looked at before the last general election. What do these various political parties actually think should happen? In what ways will they legislate? And almost none of them had any manifesto points on things like software, online privacy, all these sorts of things. So just the fact they've actually got a digital manifesto is a fantastic win in my book.
Well, we know fairly clearly what Theresa May's policy on online privacy is.
No, we don't. We know what it looks like when it was watered down by other people. We don't know what it looks like when she's the PM.
We don't know extrapolate.
We don't know how low she's willing to go.
I think the really disturbing thing about this is that online is still written with a hyphen in 2016. that's worrying.
It brought things like all the government work will, software and hardware investments will be, anything created by them will be released as FOSS. And a lot of it already is, but, it's sort of reaffirming that commitment.
Yeah.
Teaching kids code, again, this is almost reaffirming a commitment that's already been made. And they also had what they call the Charter of Digital Liberties, which they didn't go into quite as much detail on as I would like, but he talked about sort of securing or sort of legally encoding our digital freedoms. And without knowing exactly what would be legally encoded, it's hard to get too invested in that. But it did seem to be a step in the right direction, at least. It didn't seem to be encoding the state's right to remove our digital liberties, which seems to be what Theresa May wants to do.
Fair point. The commitment to use free software was made first, I think, in 2007.
It's been made a lot of times and sort of widely swept apart.
And ignored, for the last 9 years.
Yeah, so, we'll see. And there's also sort of slightly more, I don't want to say communist, but let's say lefty bits of it where he talks about community ownership of the means of production.
Old school!
As I say, for me, the big win is that they've actually got a digital manifesto, and hopefully it will spur other parties, both in the UK and elsewhere, to sort of stand up and say what they want to happen in the digital world should they get elected.
This massive multi-person online deliberation thing, which is one of the points in the digital whatnot,
you know, we will enlighten the National Education Service will enlighten the British electorate because the electorate is wrong. It needs to be enlightened.
Oh, okay.
Well, to be fair, the British electorate thought the NHS was about to get another £350 million a week.
But they told us it would.
We will create a 21st century network democracy where everybody can be a political decision maker. That's wrong. That's the wrong way to go. Oh dear.
I tried to keep my laughter dear, in. Dear.
Yes, you're right. This is an excellent. It's good that this document exists. I think I've seen something, not a standalone presentation, but I think the Green Party manifesto last year did have some quite good points on this.
I'm sure.
on this one area.
Yeah. I'm sure it's something their one MP spends a long time talking about.
We'll just have to wait until 2020 for the glorious Labour victory to see how it works in practice. But yeah, there's a lot to look forward to here.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent. Fantastic news. Thank you, Ben. So it's now time for finds of the fortnight or 3 weeks. I've been away, actually, for a couple of weeks. I made that excuse to the IRC channel before we started because a couple of people have pinged me. But still, people have offered up their fines. So thank you. Hey. Thank you to everyone.
What is it like outside, Graham?
Outside the Brexit zone or outside the house?
Just out on holiday. Is it okay?
Yeah, it was. It was really good. It was in France and it was lovely weather and lovely wine.
Thank traitor.
You. I know, sorry. So there are some excellent finds, actually, that people volunteered. I'll start with Ian Gogo, who said, homeassistant.io. I did load up the webpage to be able to get some more information on it, but is it there? Is it there? Can I quickly get to it? No. But try it. It looks like it's a great URL. Then Corruptor says Soccer CLI, which is on GitHub. I've got that one open. I just saw that. Soccer CLI.
Soccer as in the game?
Yeah, it's Soccer, S-O-C-C-E-R. A CLI for the football scores.
Cool.
That sounds pretty good.
It's like watching football on teletext all over again.
Yeah, I wonder if it would do the old teletype sound, you know, the tick, tick, I used to. So yeah, sorry.
I was expecting something more like Vim Golf there.
Yeah, yeah. I had a soccer game and watch back when I was a kid, which I really liked as well. That would have been cool. But no, you type
probably worth a lot now.
Yeah, I haven't got it anymore. It probably is. So yeah, you type in soccer plus a few arguments, and it tells you things like the scores, which is pretty cool. So that's from Corruptor. So this one's from MacPhail. I've got one. If your SSH session disconnects, you can be left with an unresponsive terminal, which doesn't respond to Control-C. It's very annoying, that. You can close the SSH session by sequentially typing enter tilde full stop period. That's good to know, because that happens all the time. I always end up killing the process.
That's not like a 4chan thing, isn't it? That's not like a way of wiping your disk.
A fork bomb. Yeah.
Surely not from MacPhail. He's surely not. So another one is from Salty, who's I think is new to the IRC channel. That's cacti.net. I found cacti recently. Network graphing using RRD tool via a lovely web-based interface. Tons of plugins. And they've also said there's also Guacamole. Which I'll put the URL in the podcast notes. It's a clientless remote desktop gateway, remote desktops through HTML5, and they say it works really well. They've said it's even easy to set up with SSH and use an SSH terminal within this remote desktop. So they were all excellent finds. Thank you very much to the IRC channel.
Can I just mention that Soccer CLI thing? you see loads of these little scripts and programs that can pull data off the internet, and a lot of the time it's easy to think, what's the point? You know, why would anybody do that when somebody can just look at a football website? But all of these things become really powerful when you start to plug them into the big sort of Unix pipeline, the way you can connect everything. So you can then connect that to your IRC channel, or then, you know, now with Raspberry Pis and little LCD displays, you can make your own football score monitor. Or what was that thing that Ben made for Linux Voice back in the day? You know the Nerf gun. You could have it that this thing shoots your cat in the face whenever Man United scores or something like that. You can pull together all these data sources and do interesting stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You could make a Sabutio set that actually played out the game in real life.
Right. That should be your next tutorial if you don't mind spending 18 months working on it.
So I've not found much. The one thing I have found, because I've just loaded the URL, is home-assistant.io, which actually looks really good. It's so this was Iangogo's discovery in the IRC channel. It's a home assistant. It's an open source home automation platform running on Python 3. And some of the example images, it looks like it's just a really way of bringing together a load of scripts and some remote control on your phone for accessing devices at home. The closest I've got to a find, because I have been away, is it's Google Translate on Android. Maybe other people have known this, but if there's a live camera mode, and if you point it at something in a foreign language, it translates.
No way.
Yeah, yeah, try it if you've got it installed. I didn't know.
What?
And it actually mimics the font, the layout, the background. So what it looks like is like a magic. It looks like magic. Point it in front of a menu, for example, say French to English, although it detects the language automatically most of the time. And you can look at the menu through your camera, through your phone, and everything has changed. It really works.
It's like real-time OCR. Yeah. It performs OCR.
Real-time OCR, but also it slots in the fonts and the words into the old, so it looks like you're taking a photo of the menu in English, for example.
That's insane.
That's
amazing.
It is.
Do you have to be online?
No, you don't. You can download it allows you to download the language files for offline use. Mm. So I took it with me and used it for a few things because I still couldn't believe it. When I first found out, somebody told me about it, you could download images on one phone and then translate them with another phone. And it's just magic. So that's my find.
If you chain like several phones together, can you get it between different languages? But like Chinese whispers and see what it says, go back to English. French to Spanish to German to Portuguese to English and see what it says in the end.
We should give it a go, yeah. Anyone else want to have a go?
I've got a very quick and non-Linux related find. It was going to be the Jeremy Corbyn backs open source, but instead, all I've got is that the building where this policy document was announced is called Newspeak House. Newspeak, as in George Orwell. Kids, if you've not heard of George Orwell, Google him.
Or watch it unfold around you.
Is it intentionally called News Speak House? Or is it like an old name that George Orwell stole?
Look, an old name that George Orwell stole. I think George Orwell invented pretty much all modern political discourse. I think for any political party, making any announcement at a building called News Speak House shows a bit of a lack of awareness. However, you might think that I couldn't possibly... Obviously, I can comment, but there we go.
I've got a couple of finds. The first one is that Google are doing a Luna X Prize, and the challenge is it's the first commercial company to send a robot, basically, to the moon, and it has to first one to travel 500 meters on the moon wins $20 million.
Awesome.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And it's been going on for a little while now. I think it finishes, so it has to happen by December next year, although there have been a few extensions, so maybe that would happen again, I don't know. But what I find really cool is that obviously there's loads of teams competing for this, and it costs quite a lot to get a robot to the moon. So some of the teams are clubbing together and going in the same launch vehicle to save money. So that means that when this launch vehicle touches down, there's then going to be a whole bunch of robots. The first one to go 500 meters wins $20 million. It's some combination of robot wars and wacky races on the moon with a $20 million stake. And this is all going to take place probably next year.
Wow, really? That's amazing. Yeah.
What a world.
Well, what are they launching them on?
They can basically go up on whatever they want. And I think they're sort of doing it in stages. So they're getting one into low Earth orbit or high Earth orbit and deploying a second stage up from there. And there's a few different groups going off in different ways. I think one's on a SpaceX flight, one's on, I can't remember who else is putting stuff up these days.
Well, I'm just thinking, if I was our lad Elon, he now has 6 rockets that he's landed that would normally be thrown in the sea. So he can fill one of them up with fuel for $300,000, chuck something onto the moon, drive a little buggy around for a bit, and then claim $20 million. I mean, it's just sensible business.
What's $20 million to Elon, though? That's just another ivory back scratcher.
Yeah, but when all you've got to do is spend $300,000 on fuel because you've got a relanded rocket, then great. It's sensible money making.
It's just a distraction from Mars.
For legal reasons, we should point out that Elon Musk only uses ivory back scratchers that were harvested from ivory killed before 1989.
Yes, sustainable ivory.
Is that the cutoff, 1989? I didn't realise it was that recent. I thought it was like 1800 and something. When they talk
for legal reasons, or if I've got this wrong, whenever it wasn't illegal.
So that's one of my finds. Anyway, yeah, there's going to be a massive robot race with a massive cash stake next year on the moon.
I love living in these times.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah, the other one, I think I've talked about this before, but I've been using Snap and Flatpak a little bit, and not in a, oh, let's try out Snap and Flatpak kind of way, but in a, oh, I need to do this thing, and Snap and Flatpak are the best ways of doing it kind of way. And it's worked really well every time. It's all been on Ubuntu with both of them. It's mostly been on Ubuntu with both of them. It's worked exactly how people said it would. You know, it's just one command, grabs everything. You can then get rid of it again afterwards. It's particularly useful when installing the latest version of software before it's in your repository. You don't have to pull down all the conflicting packages. You don't have to try and compile it and work out what 10 different versions of 10 different libraries it needs. Grab the Flatpak or the Snap, run it, do whatever you need to do with it, delete it, bang. Works a treat. And I was really skeptical. I thought it was going to be a nightmare to use both of them, but they weren't. They both worked the first time. Just by following the usual instructions and a couple of commands.
Excellent.
Well, my find is actually also related to space. And I actually found it inside the hallowed pages of Linux Voice magazine, funnily enough. Our subscribers should be getting, or should mostly have had Linux Voice issue 31 about now. It just arrived with me in Germany yesterday. And if you flip to page 98, the inside back page, we've got a little story that somebody wrote about the Robonaut R2 robot. Was that you, Graham? Or?
No, it wasn't.
That was me.
That was you, Ben, was it? Because I had no idea about this. You've got to check it out. There's a great picture and a bit of text that Ben wrote. I had no idea that on the International Space Station, as well as lots of other cool bits and bobs, they have an actual functioning robot with hands and arms that can move around and manipulate stuff. The idea is because 5 of the 6 people on the ISS are only doing maintenance of it. It's a bit of a sort of clunky old machine now in space. So they built this robot, all the information's in the magazine, but of course it's running Linux. Linux is running robots in space. So again, words you think are just quite awesome to say. Like Ben's talking about, there'll be a robot race on the moon next year, check it out. Like a sort of just a TV program to bear in mind. Yeah, we got Linux powered robots on space stations. This is the world we live in. It's wonderful.
What's really cool about that is because it's a humanoid, so yeah, it's arms, hands, legs, etc. The way of controlling it is just put on a VR mask with hand sensors and whatnot, and you act as though you're it. So it can be controlled by people on the ISS, but it can also be controlled by people on Earth. So it's a way of, you know, just getting extra hands on deck in the ISS. If they need a specialist just to do one task, rather than send them up on a rocket, just whack a helmet on their head, do the task, and go and have a cup of tea.
But that sounds like a sort of a film plot there, like some rogue NASA operative can take control of the robot and go around punching all the other people on the ISS.
A hacker called 4chan.
Exactly, yeah.
Excellent, excellent finds. Thank you, everyone.
That brings us hurtling to our halfway reminder, still to come. We may or may not have vocalised your neurons. Mike's just looking pensive. Who knows?
Sorry.
We have a voice of the masses. If you like the sound of this, but in a more professional format, you can subscribe to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com. Mike.
Hello. How's it going?
What's the news down at your end from our German correspondent?
Everything's fine here. Yeah, the sun's shining, the beer's good. Hang on, I better open my curtains. No, it's dark outside now.
Okay, so
it is ten in the evening here. In fairness,
so in terms of the podcast, the old vocalize your whatnots.
Oh yeah, I've got to admit, there's been a bit of a lack of neurons this episode, just like all the other recent episodes, actually. People, email me, send in your thoughts, send in your music, send in your paragraphs of XML that I won't read out. But we used to get some really interesting ideas and thoughts from people using Linux in schools, looking to the future, looking to the past, recounting their experiences, all sorts of great stuff. So just email me, mike@linuxvoice.com. Tell me what you're thinking, what you're doing with Linux, and within a reasonable timeline, we'll read them out on the podcast.
Thanks, Mike. And yes, you really should. You should get in touch with us, because although most of the internet is a steaming cesspool of hatred, linuxvoice.com and its associated subdomains are full of love and laughter and joy, as we're about to demonstrate now with Voice of the Masses. So this fortnight, we asked, do you care about FOSS licenses? How important are the differences between licenses to you? Are you passionate about the GPL versus BSD debate? Have you found another license that you think is the ultimate solution for FOSS? Do you think we should pay more attention to these matters? Or do you think it's all a great big bunch of flibbity-gibbetery? So kicking us off, right down here at the bottom of the list of 13 comments that we have is Safe, who always delivers the goods, much like Biggles in a Biggles anthology I had, where one of the stories was called Biggles Delivers the Goods. Safe says, FOSS licensing is like religious belief. There are those who are agnostic and those who are zealots, those that are fundamentalists and those that are modernists. Ultimately, like a religion, while there may be a path to achieving personal enlightenment and generally be good for humanity, they can also be reinterpreted to service a person's own institution's own commercial or political needs. While FOSS represents an unselfish contribution, it is noble. When there is radicalization, it detracts from the glory of our... And then it ends. Insert Stallman, Torvalds, or other deity here. I think that makes an awful lot of sense. Despite it not grammatically making sense, it does make sense. You can take from whatever license what you will and apply it for the glory of man or for its destruction. Rakios says, of course I care. Whether I understand the important distinctions between each of them is another matter. And Stuart says, I get annoyed with companies that refuse to use the GPL types of licenses, saying that they might be forced to release their code if they do. This is really not about how valuable and important their code is, but really about how crappy their code is. And that they would then have to explain to the masses this crappy code. Only when code is out there and available to be reviewed by anyone will good code be produced. Otherwise, if it works, it's good enough to ship. Now, that thing about hiding subpar code... Karen Sandler released some sort of blog post this week about the latest security audit of her of the machine that's in her heart, and it just looks utterly shocking. Really, really bad stuff that would never have been allowed to be implanted in human beings if it were released under the GPL. Mike, if that's all of you, you've released free software code. Ben, have you?
Only bits and pieces.
Only bits and pieces. Don't talk yourself down, man. The answer is yes. It's a binary question. So how important was the license for you?
I wouldn't have gone with anything weird, but between things like a GPL and a BSD, if it was something bigger, I might have cared more. But because it was only bits and pieces, I just went GPL because I couldn't be bothered to think about it.
Mike?
Yeah, I actually chose the BSD license for macOS, and I can't exactly recall why. I think it's just because it was shorter and simpler, and pretty much everything I wanted to do in macOS was to do with things being short and simple. And also, well, Linus Torvalds came out with another quote recently saying, BSD is a fine license for people who don't care about their code. You know, he's having a bit of a dig at it. But at least from my perspective, I didn't really care what happened with macOS. If I was working on something much bigger, much more productive, useful piece of software, then I'd probably go for the GPL. But for small things, I don't know, even public domain is fine to me.
And Graham, you were featured in the Mageo repositories, weren't you? Until about 15 years ago.
Yeah, I don't remember whether I had much choice at the time. So K-Album was like 1999 or the year 2000. And I think I may have had to choose the GPL version 2, and then it became GPL V3 according to Qt and KDE's linking terms. I like the idea of the GPL. I like what it represents. I'm glad that something like the BSD license exists as an alternative, but I think I'd still make the same decision today, although maybe for different reasons. It was just starting out then. And it is really complicated getting your head around the implications and the kind of social implications as well of the license that you choose. So yeah, I did give it some thought.
Well, Kevin O'Brien says, I just read a comment by Linus Torvalds explaining that the decision to use GPL was the most important part of developing Linux. Torvalds says, the GPL ensures that nobody is ever going to take advantage of your code. It will remain free and nobody can take that away from you. I think that's a big deal for community management. And then Kevin goes on to say, I think so too, and that's why I think the GPL is the best license possible, and I am passionate about that.
It's interesting that Linus seems so... keen on that when he seems to hate lawyers so much for trying to enforce that very principle.
Ah, Typhoid Mary, lawyers spread disease, etc. John says, back to BSD, I have a dislike for BSD or BSD-like licenses, as I have come across proprietary software that has taken BSD software and added greatness, like Keon with OpenSSH. With that, I can't see what they've added or broken. Too much BSD software has been taken without anything going back, hence my dislike of this.
But the point of BSD is that it allows that. The developers do that with open eyes. They know that's the case. And, you know, it often makes a lot of sense. For example, if you're writing something to use a particular piece of hardware, that you may want people just to be able to take that code and put it straight into their products. BSD license makes perfect sense because that doesn't then restrict what software it goes into. It's all about using your hardware. The same way if you just want people to use your code to make software, the BSD license is the one to choose.
Theo de Raad of the OpenBSD project has mentioned this a few times, like with OpenSSH. He said that he thinks the BSD license has meant that it's OpenSSH is absolute de facto standard everywhere for, you know, logging into remote machines, because anybody can use it. Anybody can put it on any device, proprietary. Any company can set it up on their routers and not have to think about GPL issues. And to that extent, he's right that had OpenSSH been GPL, some companies would have avoided it and made their own different versions. We might have lots of different vulnerable versions out there, but we have OpenSSH as the standard across the world because anyone can use it.
I think that's a really good example, because if you sort of look at IT security across the board, it's pretty obvious if OpenSSH didn't exist, what would exist would be a load of really sloppy, really insecure implementations of SSH, or quite possibly just no encryption at all, just telnet open ports with no encryption. And the fact that there is that BSD free license that you can include in proprietary software has made the IT world much, much more secure.
Yeah.
So there we are. What was the catalyst behind this discussion? Was it Torvalds kicking off at somebody?
Well, yeah, I think it's always interesting to get listeners and readers' backgrounds to why they feel a certain way. You know, we've all made decisions. We choose certain distros and software. We have different sort of ideological positions within the whole free software movement. And instead of just saying yes or no to X, Y, or Z, so like, why do you think this matters? Is this something we should be talking about? Is this something we should be devoting all our efforts to? Or is it, bike shedding at the end of the day where everybody's arguing about colours? And
I like that. I've not heard that before.
Yeah, check it out. It's something else from the BSD camp, bike shedding, where you want to build a bike shed and everybody ends up arguing about the colour of it rather than actually building the bike shed.
I think it's pretty plain that had Linux been released under the BSD license, it wouldn't even be around today, I don't think. Or it would be, but it would be forming the core of Windows 10 or something.
Well, I mean, the BSDs started at around the same time. They've been around for a lot longer, but started in their current form at a similar sort of time. And I think, they don't form, the form of macOS, but there's also still the free version, the free BSDs, the open BSDs, et cetera, et cetera. So but I don't think it's fair to say they would have wouldn't still have some value.
But it wouldn't have anywhere near the same amount of value. I mean, the BSDs now are a niche within a niche, whereas Linux is actually a decently sized. Well, it's a massive industry player, and it's getting there. Is it getting there on the desktop? Does it even matter anymore when every single website runs on a Linux server and all the supercomputers run on Linux? Everything embedded runs on Linux.
I really think that's only because Linux exists. I think if Linux hadn't been around, BSD would be where Linux is now.
Do you really think so? You think like FreeBSD, which is very, very similar to Linux, almost a drop-in replacement for many things. You see, looking back on, you may be right, I'm just looking back in the early 90s on the history of this, one of the things that strikes me that made Linux succeed is that Linus Torvalds was a really damn good project leader. He was efficient, he was technically knowledgeable, he made decisions and just did them, which is quite difficult in the open source world. Whereas the BSD projects, I mean, by a few years after 386 BSD had been done with, they already had three versions with FreeBSD, NetBSD, and OpenBSD. There was so much infighting there and squabbling. I know that can happen anywhere, but Linus was really like, he's still here 25 years later. There's only one kernel. There aren't a million kernel forks going around. That's quite impressive.
Yeah, you say, oh, there's only one kernel. True, but there's a few thousand distros, whereas with BSD, there is much, I'd argue there's more leadership within BSD because it's for the whole project. I mean, the kernel's basically irrelevant to the user. It's something that does its job, and that's it. Whereas, and it's all the distro, all the bits, and all the everything else that makes it useful. And in BSD, that's all tightly controlled under a single project, and in a way, it's much more coherent than it is on Linux.
Well, that is true, yeah, and that's always been the argument in favour of something like FreeBSD. It is built as an entire unit, even though it does use some GNU utilities and stuff from outside the system. It is interesting to think. It's so much what ifs and what where, what could have been. And maybe some of our listeners would like to chime in the comments, like, especially those who remember the early 90s. Imagine Linux didn't exist. Would FreeBSD be pretty much where Linux is now? I really don't know.
I wouldn't like to say it was FreeBSD, but I would say definitely one of the BSDs.
But do you not think? I mean, you were arguing before that the BSD license makes it easy for proprietary companies to just run away with code. Would that not have hindered development much more? Because, you know, Linux is...
I mean, it wouldn't necessarily have helped development, but I think there's still, it's just, you're trying to force, companies can take Linux and not contribute back to it. They can do that. They just don't make any changes, or they make them in such a way they're not useful to feed back into the project. You know, you don't have to create a pull request to comply with the GPL. You can just throw out some code that's almost impossible to merge back in. But it does. Companies have to actually invest in getting their code into the core of the Linux kernel. It's not simply complying with GPL. They don't have to pay people to fix stuff that other people would fix in time anyway. They can just sit back and consume code. So a lot of companies do, and they're perfectly entitled to do that. But big companies get involved in development, and they do that bit because it's good for them. They do it, they're a commercial entity. They're not doing it out of charity. By doing that, they get people sat on, in important decisions within Linux and they help steer it in the direction they do, and they get more momentum behind the changes they want to happen. And that would be exactly true in the BSD world as it's true in Linux.
But is it that true? You were saying before, there's a lot of things Apple have done, taken with BSD. They may not have contributed back. We know Sony's PlayStation, was it PS4, runs FreeBSD. I don't know how much they're contributing back. I don't want to judge them, but... Are they contributing back the same way that the companies that use GNU/Linux do?
Well, I mean, it is different, because there are far, far more companies using Linux than use BSD as a base of their systems. So you can't just sort of look, one for one, there should be the same number of companies. And some companies do. I mean, there are paid FreeBSD developers or companies that pay sizable chunks of money to BSD to help them out.
Yeah, true.
Right, that sounds like story time for another bedtime, because now it's bedtime. It's time for Bagpuss to play his little tune of sadness. The mics need to tidy things away. What else? Professor Yaffle is whistling. Listen to him, children. So after we've had a good sleep, we'll see you all again in 2 weeks. Anything else? Any other important messages to add?
So, yeah, thanks, Andrew. Issue 31 is on sale now, and it's gone out to all subscribers. So read it. Read all about the Robonaut R2. And, we will we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye. It's such a